court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Ronald D. Beck versus William M. Beck.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Minshew is here to argue for petitioner. Mr. Minshew has reserved 5 minutes to vote.
May it please the court. Obviously, in 20 minutes, we cannot address all the issues raised in the case, but I would like to hit some of the main points that I feel are the most important. First and foremost is the principle of stare decisis. That is, can lawyers in this state and courts in this state rely on existing opinions of this court, this Texas Supreme Court, in advising their clients and telling their clients what the rights and obligations of those parties may be in connection with a contract? I submit to you that in the case at Bar in Beck versus Beck, in 1977, the parties signed a premarital agreement that could only have been governed by what is known as the 1948 Amendment to the Texas Constitution, which did allow, under certain limited circumstances, married parties in this state to partition and exchange their properties between among themselves.
Counsel, in 1977, the parties had a very adequate remedy, didn't they? They could come in every year and do a partition agreement if they wanted to.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And would that not have totally eliminated the problem that we're here about today?
Yes, it would, Your Honor.
Did the parties do that?
No, they did not.
But that method of handling it was clearly set out under the Constitution.
Certainly was, yes, sir. Right. The 1948 amendment to the Constitution allowed the parties to get together periodically from time to time and partition or exchange between themselves property that would be community nature or exchange separate for separate or whatever they wanted to do. They could have done it daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, whatever. The parties were, they signed this agreement 4 days before they got married. They were not husband and wife when they signed the agreement. The agreement and the bad part of the agreement, if you will, simply sought to characterize property to be acquired during the marriage from the separate property of each spouse to continue to be the separate property of each spouse. That is, it sought to change the nature of earnings and income from separate property, from community to separate property. The marriage lasted a little over 3 years. It's important to note that in 78, this court handed down an opinion called Williams versus Williams. It's cited in our brief. And in Williams, the court considered an agreement identical to the Beck agreement, even signed 4 days before the marriage. You can't get any more white horse than that agreement was in Williams versus Williams. 1 year after the Beck agreement was signed, Williams versus Williams came down. This court agreed, all justices agreed, that the agreement was void ab initio and unenforceable because it contravened the clearly worded provisions of the Constitution based on the 1948 Amendment. The court further stated that the 1948 Amendment is the law that applies, and it cites many cases in the opinion, that the law in effect at the time of the agreement is the law that governs the rights and obligations of the parties to that agreement.
Why shouldn't we apply the law at the time the trial court entered the divorce decree based upon the Sadler case, which would seem to support that?
Your Honor, this is a probate case rather than a divorce case, but the point is still, I understand the court's point. The Sadler case, I believe, has been stretched and misconstrued to apply to substantive as well as procedural matters. Now, the Sadler case involved only the narrow issue, which is procedural, of burden of proof. It didn't attack the agreement itself. It didn't say the agreement is unconstitutional, as our case and as Williams does. The Sadler case merely said, what burden of proof must the husband meet to get the agreement before the court? Is it the family code as it existed when the agreement was signed, or the agreement when the divorce decree was rendered? Now, there was the court, this court, I think properly, in Sadler, said it would be the procedural rules that apply at the time the divorce is granted. However, the language of the court is, I would say, at least too broad in that it does not limit its application to procedural rules. Since at least Justice Marshall's opinion in 1825 and as reiterated by this court in its Williams case in 1978, And as further cited in DeSantis versus Wackenkut by this court in 1990, we have always applied the law, the substantive law, to the agreement when it's signed. That is, the law in place at the time the agreement is signed as to substantive matters has always been what governs. The parties are presumed to have contemplated and understood the substantive rights and obligations as the law existed at that time. That's been a well-established body of law that has never been challenged or changed. However,
in 1977, the Family Code did not prohibit itself, apart from the Constitution.
Yes, sir.
The Family Code did not prohibit this sort of agreement. Is that true or not?
The Family Code, and Williams addresses this point. Williams says that the Family Code should be construed as broadly as possible to allow the spouses to contract between and among themselves, provided the agreement did not contravene the provisions of the Constitution.
But for the 1948 provision of the Constitution, the Family Code would have permitted this arrangement.
That's correct. It would have.
Why, if the statutory law would have permitted it and the parties intended it, shouldn't a change in the Constitution, which removes the obstacle to it, validate the agreement of the parties, particularly when they operated under it both before and after that change in the Constitution?
Your Honor, the answer to that is that if it involves substantive matters, then it must be governed by the law in effect when the agreement is signed. And that's well-established law. Now, as to procedural matters, I have no problem with Sadler. Sadler should be, and I hope the court addresses that point in its opinion in this case, takes the opportunity to limit Sadler to procedural matters, because at least one court, an appellee, has cited the case in her brief, although we just now saw the opinion today, this Grossman versus Grossman out of the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals, has stretched and broadened the language of Sadler to include the law of the case, the substantive law of the case, as well as the procedural rules that should be applied. That is, it is simply said in Grossman, the husband sought to introduce a 1974 marital property agreement in a 1989 case. The wife claimed it was void ab initio. The court first rejected the agreement, apparently maybe based on Williams or whatever, we don't know. But then the husband brought in a copy of the Sadler opinion, and the court reconsidered its opinion and then admitted the agreement, found it to be all right, apparently. We don't have the points of appeal raised on appeals. We don't know if the constitutional provision, that is the void ab initio holding of Williams, was even raised by the lawyers in the case. We don't know that. All we know is the court cited Sadler as a case which upholds the validity of the agreement. That is, makes it retroactive. In other words, if we don't prohibit the retroactive application of constitutional amendments, we are getting into an area that involves constitutional questions for the parties to take to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it also contravenes our Constitution, Article 1, Section 16, which says, well, we won't make ex post facto laws.
Retroactivity generally is offensive when it invalidates vested rights, but this retroactivity would validate the intent of these parties in this contract. But that seems a slightly different problem.
Your Honor, I disagree, because Mr. Beck, let's say in 1977 he signed the agreement. In 1978, if his lawyer had shown him a copy of the Williams opinion, he could have said, Mr. Beck, you're not bound by this agreement that you just signed, and if you want to go to court and avoid it, you can. It's white horse. It's exactly the same agreement you signed. You can go to court in 1978, 1979, and 1980, and you can avoid this agreement, and you will receive your share of the wife's community income from her separate property, because this agreement is not binding on you. You have a vested right to seek to set it aside, in other words. If we retroactively apply the 1980 amendment, which would have allowed that type of agreement, then we're taking Mr. Beck's rights away from him. So it does affect the substantive vested rights of the parties.
Were both parties represented by counsel at the time the agreement was entered into?
I believe that the parties signed an agreement in the office of one lawyer. I do not know, and I don't know that that's even important to the outcome of the case.
Well, the reason I ask is because I'm interested in what your position is on the estoppel or waiver of constitutional provisions argument.
Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that point. The estoppel and waiver questions, I believe, have a short answer, and that is simply based on the Williams case, you cannot revive a dead animal by blowing air on it. That is, if it's a void ab initio agreement, which is what this court said unanimously on that issue in Williams, you can't come along by subsequent actions or whatever and bring it back to life any more than you can make an amendment retroactive and bring it back to life.
Shouldn't we be concerned, though, about an unscrupulous spouse lulling perhaps another spouse into an agreement which they know or is void?
Well, of course, that's not a problem anymore because the Constitution has been amended as early as 1980 to permit this type of agreement. They can just about agree to anything they want to now.
Let's talk about this case.
All right, sir.
Hypothetically.
All right.
Should we endorse that sort of activity?
I'm not sure it's a matter of endorsing activity, Your Honor, as it is in following the established case law of the state. That is, William versus William has any meaning, and it says that this agreement is void, then we simply have to say the agreement's void, and no matter what, if there is any overreaching, and that isn't an issue in the case because it went up on the summary judgment on the matter of law. Is it void or is it good? The trial court says it's good. The Court of Appeals says it's good. And the trial court didn't give a reason why it's good. The Court of Appeals stretched and twisted the constitutional provision itself and said that we read it differently than the Supreme Court did in Williams. We don't think the Supreme Court knew what they were doing. We think we're going to try a little different and innovative approach to the construction, and we think it permits an exchange of properties.
The 1948 amendment required, did it require a formality of coming forward technically and specifically partitioning specific property on a periodic basis? You said it can be daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, or whatever periodic basis they want to do it. The language of the constitutional amendment is very unspecific on that. It just says they can exchange, they can partition and exchange and change the nature by agreement of this property. This prenuptial agreement was entered into in 1977. Williams' case was handed down in 1988. The people were content with the agreement. It wasn't specifically authorized by the Constitution until 1980. Mr. Beck died in 1981. Is that correct?
That's correct, John. Except the Williams was in 78.
Presuming that they were cognizant of the court's decision in the Williams case, but they continued with this agreement. What formalities are required for a partition in exchange? They were willing to rely on this agreement as their partition in exchange. What formalities other than this would be required?
Your Honor, the 1948 amendment, by implication at least, required the parties to get together and do the swapping as the property existed because it specifically refers only to existing property.
They lived together as calves were born on a daily basis from the herd, as royalties were produced from oil wells or stock investments, dividends were paid. They lived together on a daily basis. Did they have to sit down at the kitchen table every day and say, hey, okay, I'm going to exchange this and make it your separate property. We're going to partition. They had to go through that formality every day.
Yep.
Rather than live by the agreement that they both willingly entered into and under the advice of counsel and they thought they had up until the time of Mr. Beck's death.
Your Honor, if the Constitution is to be read as it's written and if the Williams case is to be followed, the answer is yes.
Can the state impose that kind of formality on individuals? I mean, the Constitution is supposed to protect our liberties.
It did impose that formality by the constitutional amendment, and it said it has to do with existing property.
Counsel, is it not true that partition agreements were normally done once every year?
Generally speaking, yes, sir.
And is not the reason for this simply because they would have the amount of interest that was earned from bank accounts and other things, and thus they could partition with reasonable certainty at a fixed period each year?
That's correct, John.
Was there any law on the books at the time to support the theory that you could do one agreement that would last for infinity?
There was not. In fact, the law was the opposite. The Williams case says you cannot prearrange or change the constitutional nature of property by a prospective agreement. That's what the holding was.
There is a word that is frequently used in matrimonial law, characterization. Okay. And is that not a key word in this case?
It is, Your Honor, because that's exactly what Williams addresses, and that's what our Beck agreement does. It sought to characterize the property as separate rather than community, and the Constitution doesn't provide you that you can characterize the property differently. It says you can partition.
Would you define time to time for me, from time to time?
Some time to time can be any day, any year, any month.
I don't care what the individual's customary practice was. I'm talking about from time to time.
Anytime the parties want to, Your Honor.
Okay. We'll enter into this agreement now, and in 1980 we'll sit down and do the rest of it. 1980, the Constitution authorized, he dies in 81. What does time to time mean?
Anything the parties want to
open, it's vague, and yes, it can mean anything.
But it only applies to
the
existing
property.
The
day before property. I die, sweetheart, we'll sit down and do it.
Yes, sir. It only applies to existing property, though, and Williams is very clear on that point. We can't characterize it in advance. That 1980 amendment did provide that.
1980 amendment did not ratify what they did in 1977 because they continued it. They never changed it. They never altered it.
Counsel, let me ask you.
Yes, sir.
Did not the law provide to deal with existing property? So if you had an agreement and the calf was born the day before you signed the agreement, then it would cover that calf. But if a calf was born a week later, it would not be covered by that agreement, would it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Because the property had to be in existence at the time you signed the partition agreement.
All the cases agree with that. Yes, sir. Including Williams primary.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please the court? Ms. Stacey Johnson will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, my name is Stacey Johnson. I'm from Sherman, Texas, where I practice law with the firm of Henderson, Bryan, and Wolf, and I'm pleased to be here today representing Lillian Beck, the respondent in this lawsuit. Now, the legal question before the court today is whether the summary judgment granted in favor of my client can be sustained on any basis presented in the Court of Appeals. The equitable question before the court today is whether Lillian's adult stepson should be allowed to take money that Lillian holds as a result of events occurring long before she ever married the stepson's father, Audrian, when to allow him to do so is in direct contravention of Audrian Beck's right, or Audrian Beck's intent.
Counsel, do you know why they didn't bother to comply with existing law regarding partition agreements?
Well, Your Honor, I disagree very strongly with plaintiff's interpretation of the 1948 law. I think under the 1948 law, their agreement did comply with it.
Do you agree that what the Court of Appeals says is in direct contravention of Williams?
No, I don't, Your Honor, because I think that the law that was in effect in 1977, which was the 1948 amendment to the Constitution, provided for two types of transactions. And I think if you'll very carefully look at that provision of the Constitution and try to put away the conventional mindset or the popular wisdom that probably arises as a result of Williams, you'll see that there are these two separate types of transactions that are authorized. One is the partition, and that's what Williams dealt with. The other is an exchange.
Don't those have to do with existing property rather than property to be acquired in the future?
The partition agreement very clearly, or the partition type of transaction very clearly by the language of the Constitution, is limited to only existing property. The exchange language is not limited in that way.
What was the purpose of the 1980 constitutional amendment which authorized which allowed the parties to create separate property out of community property, in essence, a future acquired property?
Your Honor, my feeling is that the purpose of that amendment was to clarify the existing state of the law.
It was not in response to this court's decision in the Williams case?
My response to that would be no. I think the 1948 amendment to the Constitution is sufficiently broad to allow, and says on its face, that spouses can exchange the community interest of one spouse in any property for the community interest of the other spouse in any property. And I think there, the distinction between existing property in reference to partition and any property in reference to the exchange of community interest is determinative of that issue. So although the 48 Constitution didn't expressly say then existing nor future acquired, I think that the fact that any is the word describing the type of property that it can extend to is determinative.
Wasn't the 48 Amendment to allow parties to do something that under our community property law they'd never been permitted to do before? That is, to change the nature of property. As I recall, that there was a total prohibition on tampering with separate property or community property that was produced during the marriage in order to protect the respective spouses. Specifically, it was rather chauvinistic rule to protect women.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. My understanding is that that's exactly correct.
The 48th Amendment recognizes that, hey, it's not always a case of overreaching. It's not always a case of exploitation. People should be able to sit down and protect their property, the property interests that they bring into the marriage and the produce of those property interests.
And this is
specifically what the 48th Amendment was aimed at doing. It was not aimed at putting roadblocks in their way or lulling them into traps.
That's
it was calculated,
correct.
And the intent was to allow them to do this. And the intent of the parties in the Internet agreement is to do exactly that.
I agree with you completely, and I'd take it a step further and say that all the subsequent amendments which followed the 48th Amendment were, again, merely to clarify the existing state of the law, because the 48th Amendment did speak in very general terms.
The 80th Amendment was clarification of the 48th Amendment?
Yes, sir, Your Honor, I do. And I think the 87 amendments are further clarification of the 80. I think it's been the policy in the state all along since 48 to allow spouses to enter into these agreements, into marital property agreements.
So you don't ever reach a question of retroactivity for the 80 constitutional amendment?
Well, our position...
The main thing is that these people know what they're doing, and so it did require a formality.
That's correct.
So if they know what they're doing, they're cognizant of it and hopefully doing the advice.
Yes, sir. But to answer your question, Chief Justice, we take the position here that this agreement was valid under 88 law, 81 law, 88 being the date that we had the trial court judgment here, 81 law being the date of dissolution, or 87 law, that it was really valid under all three states of the law. I think the preliminary question before the court here today is, what law are you going to decide should apply in this case? And we feel very strongly that it should be the current state of the law based upon the holding in Sadler and the Court of Appeals cases construing it.
Counsel, I want to be sure I understand now exactly what property we're talking about here. Petitioner does not claim for the estate of Mr. Beck any of respondent's property that was her property prior to 1977.
That's my understanding.
The 1977 agreement did not transfer any property that she had by the petitioner's interpretation to him. So all that we're talking about is property that was accumulated by the separate estates during the marriage.
That's correct.
And the petitioner claims then that the property that was accumulated by the separate property of Mrs. Beck is community property.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
And so that's the property we're talking about.
That's correct. Right. We're talking about only the income generated by her separate property during her marriage to the petitioner's father.
Counsel, was any of that property in the form of stock dividends?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
Because if it were in the form of stock dividends, it would still remain separate property, would it not?
I don't want to go out on a limb here. I can't answer your question that well.
We're talking mainly about interest, are we not, on bank accounts?
Yes, that's correct.
And he's not claiming any of the principal. He's just saying that the interest is community property.
Well, actually, I think probably the property we're talking about here is not limited to interest on bank accounts. Mrs. Beck's first husband was Jack Massengale. They married relatively young. He became a very prominent businessman up in Sherman in Grayson County. He was one of the founding partners in the Sherman Foundry. He died, and I don't remember how many years they were married, but he died at some point in time after they'd had several children together. His ownership in that business was passed to Mrs. Beck, and it was an ongoing operation, and she retained an ownership interest in there. So I think that the property we're actually talking about here the most is the income generated by her ownership interest in the Sherman Foundry.
If it were a cash dividend, clearly it would be community property.
Yeah.
Do you see the distinction between a stock dividend and a cash dividend?
No, I don't, Your Honor. I'm not a marital property expert by any means, and I don't practice in this area of the law extensively. This case and a PI case involving some adoption law connotations and a few uncontested divorces is about all I do.
Counsel, I can't
address that.
Let me pursue my point just a little bit further, be sure I understand. Now then, is it your interpretation of what the petitioner asked for here is to say that at no time during the existence of this contract did it affect the ownership of the of the separate property of Mrs. Beck? That, in other words, it was void and at no time was it operational?
That is my understanding of the petitioner's position here today. Yes, sir.
Counsel, how do you differentiate partition and exchange?
Under the 1948 amendment, or practically speaking.
Practically
speaking, I think there's a difference. I think if you're talking about a partition, you're most commonly referring to a piece of real property, and it can either be community or separate in nature, but somehow you're going to divide the ownership of that property and end up making one piece of property two pieces of property. An exchange, on the other hand, I think is going to be a situation like we have here where we have two interests. We have Audrian's interest in Lillian's separate property, and we have Lillian's interest in Audrian's separate property, and those two interests are simply being exchanged. There's not a division of one piece of property there.
Counsel, you could easily partition property where one spouse receives lot A and one spouse receives lot B, which are adjoining pieces of property, could you not?
Yes, sir, Your Honor, you could.
Now, that would be a partition. What's the difference between that and an exchange?
Well, again, I think that started with the premise that there was one piece of property being divided, whereas here we've got two different property interests that are simply being switched or traded.
Excuse me. Let me ask, why is this no more than a mere agreement between the parties to establish the character of property prior to its acquisition?
I believe you're quoting from the Williams case, Your Honor.
Right.
And to address that, we feel like the Williams case is not controlling here for several reasons. The first being that Williams very clearly dealt with a partition.
Would you mind, please, if you can respond to my question, and then I'd be glad, and then go on and explain. Why is this no more than a mere agreement between the parties to establish the character of the property prior to its acquisition?
That may be what this is, Your Honor, but if it is, it's an authorized way to do it.
Okay.
It's authorized as the exchange under the language of the Constitution.
1948 amendment.
That's correct.
Verified by the 1980 amendment to the Constitution.
As I understand your argument, essentially what you're saying is it's the expressed intent of the parties in the 1977 agreement that should control here, as opposed to some very vague requirement of any subsequent formalities that might be argued are in the 1948 amendment. You're arguing that there are no subsequent formalities required.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In exchange.
That's correct. I think that the marital property agreement, if you look at what it says, even though it doesn't use the word exchange literally, clearly evidences that that's what's happening here, and I don't think there's a requirement that the word exchange be used there.
It also has to be your argument that this is what the 1948 amendment was intended to effectuate.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. We think that this agreement was perfectly valid under the 1948 amendment to the Constitution. And to go back and answer a question that Justice had asked to the petitioner's attorney with regard to the execution of the agreement, both parties were represented by counsel at the time that it was executed. In fact, Lillian Beck was represented by Joe Keith, who is a Sherman attorney. Audrian Beck was represented by Murray Nance, another Sherman attorney. The agreement was actually executed and notarized by Murray Nance, who was Audrian's attorney at the time.
Were the estoppel or waiver arguments raised by summary judgment evidence?
Yes, sir. We feel that they were. We feel that Audrian's signature on the contract and the language of the contract in and of itself evidence his intent to waive these rights. And there was no controverting evidence presented.
So that's what you rely upon for your estoppel and waiver argument?
Yes, sir. As well as Audrian Beck's conduct throughout his lifetime, that he followed the terms of the agreement and he went forward under it. He died under it, intending for it to be enforced. It's only the plaintiff who now comes in and is attempting after the fact to acquire some financial benefit as a result of his father's second marriage to Mrs. Beck.
If we divested our judgment to Mrs. Beck of the property that's being sought by the plaintiff in the case.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't hear you.
If we divested Mrs. Beck by the property that's being sought by the plaintiff in this case, then we would be acting directly contrary to what you argue the intent of the 1948 constitutional amendment was, clarified by subsequent amendments, where you argue, and the obvious intent of the parties.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. And we feel that that's one of the reasons why if you interpret Sadler in such a way that it does apply and govern here, and that that we are actually under 1981 or 1988 law, that
we're
carrying out the intent of the parties.
We would be the protection of both the law and the parties intended in this case. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's exactly correct.
I realize you told us you don't practice much in this area. There's been a suggestion in the briefs that this may be consequential to our jurisprudence because of agreements which remain and preceded the 80 change in the Constitution. Do you have a response to whether this is going to be more widespread or less widespread, the effect of our decision in this case?
I don't think I was following your question, Your Honor.
How many agreements do you think this will affect in the state of Texas, our decision in this case?
Well, I think your decision here will be significant. And that's a difficult question for me to gauge. I think that obviously it's the older agreements that will be more greatly affected, and I presume that in between 1948 and 1980, it was not as common a thing as perhaps it is now to execute these agreements between parties, but I think that the parties that were doing so did so for the same reason that we do it today, to provide some protection in the marriage, regardless of how it's dissolved, and to, in this case, the reason they wanted this agreement was because they were both very elderly at the time of the marriage. They both had prior marriages. Audrian was even retired. They had adult children, grandchildren, and I think Mrs. Beck even had great-grandchildren, and they decided that they wanted what they had accumulated prior to their marriage to go down to their natural heirs. And I think that's an appropriate basis to support this kind of an agreement.
Counsel, we have two elderly people today, both in their 80s, married, and they do a premarital agreement, but they, for whatever reason, do not comply with the requirements that set forth in the law, and they die. Should we give full faith and credit to their agreement because that was their intent? And remember, these two people stand in front of a video camera and say, we are elderly, we've been divorced before, we want this to go down to our children, but they do not comply with the law as it is written today. Should we give and should we enforce the agreement even though they have not complied with the law in existence?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's one that's difficult for me to answer. To start with, I think it would be very difficult for me to imagine, except for perhaps not complying with some of the procedural requirements of the statute, how an agreement would be limited substantively. I mean, clearly you can do this under the law today.
But you must follow the law today.
I'm going to answer that in a kind of a multi-pronged way. I think that, first of all, there's precedent in Texas for applying the laws retroactively, so to speak. The very decision that the plaintiff relies on, Williams against Williams, was a 1973 marital property agreement interpreted under a 1975 family code provision. I think we take, in addressing community property issues, it's my understanding that we look at community property as having only one strata here in Texas, and that's why we take the current law in determining whether something is or isn't or shouldn't be community property. That's the best I can do in answering you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
You did very well.
Counsel, is the morning before Mr. Beck passed away, Mr. and Mrs. Beck had been sitting at the breakfast table, and he said, honey, remember back before we married, we entered into a premarital agreement? She said, yes. He said, well, I've been thinking about that, and I called my lawyer to drew that up, and he said, I asked him if that was still good, and he said, well, there have been some changes in the law, but it's good today. Are you still satisfied with it? And she said, yeah, I'm still satisfied with it. Of course, we have no way of knowing whether or not that happened, but he did survive past the time of the change in the Constitution. It could have happened. If a contract is valid today, even though it may have gone through some period of time where it may not have been, are you saying that it is no longer valid?
Your Honor, I'm saying that if it went through a period of time where it's void under existing law, it cannot be revived by anything other than a new agreement or a novation, a re-signing, a ratification in writing to comply with the law after 1980. That is, I think the parties could have very well done that. If they, as Ms. Johnson says, they both had lawyers, why didn't they simply go back after the 1980 amendment? They had time to do it.
If
re-sign
we,
an agreement.
I present, it seems to me that most people, if they understand that the contract is legal, won't know that perhaps there was a time when it was not, and they wouldn't have any reason to go back and say, well, we've got to do this over again because a couple of days there, it was void.
Well, it was more than, it was about 3 years, Your Honor, but the point is, if it's void, the word void has a clear legal meaning. It means it doesn't exist for all purposes. It's legally dead. and to bring it back to life, you have to re-sign it or ratify it, bring it back to life by a new agreement. It's void. Now, they could have partitioned the day before he died. They could have partitioned all the existing property, and they could have said, now, we're going to comply with the 80 Amendment. We're going to say that everything else that comes in from separate, I mean, from separate is going to stay separate. They could have done that. No problem.
Between 1948 and 1980, we have no idea how many agreements of this nature, of this design, or perhaps even identical, it may have been a form, I don't know, were executed by couples about to marry in this state of all ages.
That's correct.
Across the board. There may have been maybe tens of thousands. We don't know.
That's correct.
Between 1948 and 1980, or sometime during that time frame, and I'm not sure when the language in the Family Code specifically authorized this type of agreement. Family Code said it was legal. You look at the language in the Constitution and nothing in there to tell you that this agreement does not comport with its requirements until, as you argue, the Williams case came along in 1978. These people don't know the Williams case was decided. They have this agreement. They're relying on this agreement. How many? That's 11 years ago that the 80 Amendment was adopted. These people today are still relying. Are you saying that all of these people need to go back to their lawyers, need to run to their lawyer's office and execute a new agreement, that the agreements that they lived under before 1980 and have lived under for 11 years since 1980 are void ab initio, and they have no protection under the law? Is that what you're telling us?
That's correct. Your Honor, if we're going to follow DeSantis versus Wackenhut, if we're going to follow John Marshall at the 1825 opinion.
You keep saying that. This opinion isn't in any of the briefs. What opinion are you talking about?
It's cited in the DeSantis versus Wackenhut.
Is it Gibbons?
It's written by Justice Heck. It was in 1990. It was cited in the amicus curiae brief filed by the Geary, Stahl, and Spencer firm that was filed in this court.
Counsel, for all you know, since we're dealing with hypotheticals, those people who had agreements before 1980, many of them have probably gone back and done it as it should have been done. Is that possible?
Exactly. That's what they should do.
Why should they do this if they thought that took care of it? It affects, obviously.
Well, Your Honor, if we're going to go by what the law says and the Constitution said at the time it was signed, we have to do it. They have to do it. They simply must. We can't just retroactively backdate constitutional amendments. Now, I think the court...
I see nothing in the 48 amendments of the Constitution that says you've got to go in there on any specific time basis to do this.
No, it says from time to time.
And nothing in there says it requires any particular form.
That's correct. It's got to be in writing is all. Some kind of can be a scratch on the back of the tube before if they want to, but they got to do it from time to time to partition. Now,
is there any evidence at any time that either of the backs renounced this agreement?
There is not, Your Honor. The question...
Do you agree that if you win in this case, that we have contravened the intent of the parties?
We probably have, Your Honor, but parties can't intend around the law. That is, you can't give a life to an instrument that's void if the court and this court... In the Williams versus Williams, it's clear you can't distinguish it from this case. It's impossible. All you can do is stretch the Constitution, as the Court of Appeals has done in this case, in effect, overrule Williams. That's all you can do with it. You can't distinguish it. And if we're going to apply the law of the contract to the day it was signed, if we're going to be consistent, we have to do that.
Also, if we rule with the respondent, have we not said to the people of Texas who expressed in their Constitution that we're contravening what you want?
I'm not sure I understand.
The constitutional remedy is quite clear.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. There's a provision in the law since 1980. The parties can do exactly what Mr. and Ms. Beck did. No problem.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank
that
you,
concludes
Your Honor.
The argument. And the second calls, the court will take another recess.